energy prices are the new egg prices.
We are really at an unprecedented moment for the U.S. energy landscape, where we're seeing this really huge energy demand growth, especially for electricity. From 2020 to 2026, we are actually seeing a growth rate of about 1.7% every year, and that number is only getting bigger.
Suddenly, entire gubernatorial races were centered on the price of electricity.
What they will notice is their utility bill. When certain bills are going up, people pay attention, and they pay attention very quickly. What voters believe to be true is infinitely more important than what is actually true.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Power Perspectives. I'm Kinsey Grant Baker, and we have a good one lined up today. It was only a couple of months ago that key 2025 elections placed energy in the national political spotlight. The headline was everywhere. Energy prices are the new egg prices. Suddenly, entire gubernatorial races in states like Virginia and New Jersey were centered on the price of electricity. And candidates who ran on platforms of keeping those power prices low, they won. They won big. So what made this last election cycle different? Why were utility bills and large load queues suddenly the sexiest issue for voters? And most importantly, what can we learn as these energy-first candidates take office about the upcoming 2026 midterms? Because it's becoming clearer and clearer, energy is political, and not just when it comes to climate or the energy transition. Increasingly, everything about the process of producing and delivering electrons to a widening customer base is becoming an issue of left and right. And I want to understand where that leaves us, how politicking might change the power industry, and what we might expect this year and into fall's midterms. And I'm sure we'll probably also talk about Venezuela at some point too. We're covering a lot, and we are doing it with a superstar guest whose last appearance on this show earned her the title of most popular Power Perspectives guest of all time. Insight so good, we had to bring her back. It's Andrea Klebo, associate at Goldwyn Global Strategies and non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center. Andrea, welcome back to Power Perspectives. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's been a busy week, as I'm sure you can imagine. But I'm very excited to be back here, thrilled to be talking about this topic that is very personal to me as I am in Virginia. I'm right here in Northern Virginia with all these beautiful data centers right here in my backyard. So this issue definitely hits home for me in a big way. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion and talking about the wider consequences of all this.
Absolutely. Me too. And I'm glad that you're framing this with this personal, you know, the personal element here. A lot of people who are listening to this, I'm sure, have maybe a data center in their backyard, maybe some property nearby that the, you know, utility XYZ or tech company XYZ is looking at. So this is something that hits home for a lot of people. We have a lot to cover. I'm super amped to do it. So let's start here. You know, before we dig into the 2026 part of this conversation, I want to hit rewind for just a second. It's been about a year since you joined us the first time to talk about Trump 2.0 expectations. That conversation really centered a lot on, you know, tariffs, environmental policy, regulation rollbacks, resurgent oil and gas industry. Now that we're a full year into this second Trump administration, has the White House surprised you at all?
No, that's a great question. What a year it was. And frankly, what a year it's been. So certainly, last year was a fascinating year for the energy world in a lot of different ways. It's interesting to me that we started off, and we talked a lot about this in our last podcast, with the administration having this, what we called shock and awe approach when it came to environmental regulation, deregulation rather, and the robustness of its support and the importance of the role of fossil fuels and especially upstream energy production in the eyes of this administration. I would say that I was quite surprised by the degree to which the Trump administration's approach really surpassed even my own expectations, really pushing the energy dominance agenda, not just on a domestic front, which I think we widely expected, but also in terms of its foreign policy, especially on the trade front. And increasingly, it seems to be with military action overseas, as we have seen quite explicitly. But despite all of that, I noted that while we started off the year with this big focus on fossil fuels and this big focus on the upstream of the U.S. energy sector, we really changed as we got toward the end of the year, and the focus really became about electricity and the role of power and power demand and downstream issues like transmission and distribution around energy consumption, the end user, regular people buying energy. And it's intriguing to me that that narrative really turned in a way that it feels like the administration was maybe not prepared for.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that they might have been caught a little on their back foot when it comes to these conversations about electricity prices. And we'll certainly get into the left and right of all of this, which party has really seized on electricity prices, which maybe has an opportunity to or might in the future. But I think that, you know, before we get into any of that, I'm curious to hear a little bit more about your perspective on why we're having this conversation in the first place. You know, why this more downstream transmission and distribution, why this has become such a hot button issue. So talk to me a little bit more about what feels different in today's energy reality. You know, what makes this something we're so eager to politicize, especially after, you know, a decade or more of this sort of feeling, you know, lucky if we maybe crack the top 10 in terms of issues that matter to voters. Now, suddenly it's issue number one for a lot of people. What do you think has changed most?
Absolutely. I mean, it's an incredible question. I love looking at history to sort of think about where we're going. If I were to put this very bluntly, that was then and this is now. We are really at an unprecedented moment for the U.S. energy landscape in a way that very few people could have remotely predicted even 5 or 6 years ago, where we're seeing this really huge energy demand growth, especially for electricity. And this is not just happening in one neighborhood. This is not a Northern Virginia problem anymore. This is happening across the country from coast to coast. As I was preparing for this discussion, I took a look at some information from the Energy Information Administration. And they showed in this really interesting chart that from about 2005 to 2020, U.S. power consumption grew at about 0.1% every year. So in real terms, that's basically negligible. But from the most recent data they've looked at, from 2020 to 2026, we were actually seeing a growth rate of about 1.7% every year. And that number is only getting bigger. That is probably a conservative estimate of the rate of growth in power demand and consumption that we're seeing. I looked at a different McKinsey analysis that projected a 3.5% annual growth rate through 2040. So effectively, we are seeing an exponential change when it comes to the amount of power that Americans need to conduct their daily lives. And that's happening for a number of reasons. But of course, the big one that everyone is talking about is the role of data centers. And this is obviously a big piece here. And frankly, I would argue that it is a growing piece and a growing part of this perceived energy crisis. But I want to emphasize here up front that it really is more than that. There's a lot of reasons for why this is happening, because really, the current wave of hyperscaling and the growth of data centers that we're thinking about right now, this has really been only happening for a couple of years so far. But longer term, we've seen growing demand for manufacturing power in the U.S. More houses, more residences, more people wanting to buy a house, the reshoring of some industrial production, and rapid electrification, both in industry, but also throughout the economy. We've seen growth of more and more electric vehicles on the road, for example. These are all things, in addition to all of our little gadgets and devices that we all love so much, that are adding to the power demand growth puzzle. So I think that the next question then becomes, okay, well, that's all well and good, but why does that matter to voters? Well, at the end of the day, if demand for a product, in this case, power, is going up, and you don't have enough supply to meet that, then your prices are going to go up too. Well, why is supply not meeting the demand? Great question. That's because the problems that we have in the U.S. power sector are not new themselves. They've been driven by a number of pre-existing factors, like a strangled U.S. permitting system. We've been struggling for a decade now to get comprehensive permitting reform done in the U.S. There's a bill in the Senate right now that has very troubled odds based on a number of reasons. And generally, throughout the U.S., we have a very aged infrastructure system. This is especially true in areas like New England, where much of the existing power and generation infrastructure is quite old, and you need a lot of money and investment to fix those kinds of problems. So back in, let's say, that 2005 to 2020 time period, this wasn't really that big of an issue because you could kind of paper over those problems because power demand growth was very, very small. But now, we're in a whole new ballgame because the game is changing with respect to how much power is needed to power the American people and increasingly all of these new data centers that are coming online soon.
Yeah, it's such an important point to make. You know, it's not just the data centers. It's this entire modern economy runs on clean, reliable, affordable electricity and having ready access to that. With this in mind, though, it almost seems like a Russian nesting doll of issues to keep in mind when we're thinking about the final product being an increase in the average everyday customer's utility bill at the end of every month. I'm curious how that is characterized to voters. You know, there's tension there between voters who see a data center being built saying, well, that's what it is. It's maybe difficult to explain to them, well, it's that and this, this and this and aging infrastructure and, right, you know, a litany of other reasons behind your increase in prices for electricity. So how do we characterize that to voters, or maybe even how are voters thinking about that, if at all, when they're at the ballot box? Can you explain that tension a little bit?
Right. At the end of the day, very few people, like I'm doing in my day-to-day job, very few people are out there reading, you know, 20, 30 page analyses of U.S. permitting law. That's not the kind of thing that the vast majority of people are going to do on a day-to-day basis, because they have other responsibilities. They have jobs and families and other things to take care of. So what they will notice is their utility bill. When bills are going up, and we saw this very starkly in the Biden years, when certain bills are going up, people pay attention, and they pay attention very quickly, and they look for a culprit and they look for a reason. And one of the things that I think is really important to just frame this conversation is remembering that when it comes to politics, especially American politics, what voters believe to be true is infinitely more important than what is actually true. We could talk all day long about all of the complicated reasons for why power demand is going up right now. We can also have, in my opinion, a very legitimate discussion about how artificial intelligence could potentially be a benefit to managing some of our permitting and some of our infrastructure challenges here in the U.S. But right now, voters are not really interested in that message because they're dealing with the day-to-day reality that they are paying more for something that used to cost them less, and they're not getting any added benefit. I just got a letter from my own homeowners association a couple days ago informing me that our fees were going up because, you guessed it, utility prices are going up. So this is happening across the board. And here in Virginia, we've been dealing with this for some time. But now it's increasingly beyond our state, beyond Texas even, is another good example. And this is increasingly happening elsewhere as well. So again, you could talk about the complicated reasons all day long, but voters are looking for an answer. They're looking for somebody to blame, and they're looking, most importantly, for a solution.
And when it comes to those solutions, I think it's important to keep in mind, you know, that idea of what people believe versus what is true. I think the difference there, the bridge that we can build between those two is rhetoric, right? That's campaigning. That's having something mm-hmm. to run on. That's having a platform. And clearly, it really resonated with voters when we look at races like New Jersey and Virginia in 2025. So let's talk a little bit about those and how they might inform 2026. You know, do you see, when we're thinking about this resurgence of interest in energy, obviously driven by many things, chief among them, utility bills and electricity prices. When we're looking at these races, like in New Jersey and Virginia, where they were, you know, hotly contested, they were in the national right. spotlight. This was huge. It was huge for energy as an industry. It was huge for politics. It was huge for these politicians. Can you tell me a little bit more about why those races especially mattered? And if you were surprised at all that they kind of played out the way that they did?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to really understand why we saw the campaigns lean into energy the way that they did, we have to step back a little bit and kind of remember where we are in terms of American politics right now. I would argue that the policies and the rhetoric of the Trump administration really put the Republican Party and all of their candidates who were running this past fall in a bit of an uncomfortable position where they had to campaign on energy in a way that was not really favorable to them. Now, I want to make a caveat here. Obviously, we only saw a few elections. We can't over extrapolate in terms of the amount of data we have from that very small sample size. But I really do feel that what we saw this past November, and frankly, what we're seeing right now, wasn't about just one election. And what's really fascinating to me about this is that the Trump administration was reelected on a wave of anger around inflation. And one of those areas was inflation and energy. Now, the Trump administration was really thinking about this in terms of inflation for oil prices. And they're still very concerned about that, again, as we've seen ample evidence of over the last week. But they weren't really thinking as much, it seems, about electricity prices necessarily and some of the challenges that were there. And again, the Trump administration did not create these problems. Again, permitting, infrastructure, regional challenges, geopolitical crises all over the place, the impacts of climate change, making it harder and harder to build power infrastructure and protect it when you have billion-dollar disasters happening every single year. But what the Trump administration did that I think was really important how people started thinking about this was they made themselves the pro-AI presidency at a time when artificial intelligence capital expenditure was skyrocketing and really expanding its footprint both in the American consciousness and, frankly, on our land in a really big way. Throughout the last year, electricity prices ballooned across the country. And again, that's not wholly the result of new data centers or the role of artificial intelligence. But it was still happening, and it didn't seem that the Trump administration really had their eye closely on this issue. I took a look at one recent report that showed the U.S. households are paying about 9.6% more in utility bills over 2025 versus 2024. That is a massive increase, and some regions of the country saw even double that level of inflation on those bills. Another analysis I looked at showed that over the past summer, power prices jumped more than twice as fast as the overall cost of living. Again, these are massive increases, and it wasn't clear with the Trump administration really embracing AI and talking up this idea of America winning the AI revolution that didn't necessarily mesh with how voters were thinking about these issues as they were seeing these bills skyrocket. And I would note that popular opinion towards AI is frankly not getting better. If anything, it seems to be going downhill. Pew Research Center came out with some interesting data that went public right before the November elections. And that really showed in a big way that Americans' distrust of AI as a benefit for society has really gone down very significantly. I believe one of the numbers I looked at showed that back in 2021, about 37% of people they polled in a survey said they were more concerned than excited about AI in daily life. That number of more concerned than excited jumped up to 50% in just a few years. So, and again, this was a shift in how the culture was thinking about these issues at a time when the Trump administration was strongly embracing artificial intelligence and, by extension, the consequences of having more and more of these data centers springing up all over the country.
With all of this in mind, when we're thinking about the outcomes of these elections that we're talking about, we're thinking about the general consensus of how voters are feeling when they're going to the ballot box. We also have to keep in mind whether or not it's possible to make good on a lot of these campaign promises of getting electricity prices lower and keeping them lower. I'm curious if you have any insight on whether that's possible. You know, when we're looking to states like Virginia and New Jersey, where these promises are made of capping electricity prices, of keeping data centers out, how likely is that to really happen when we sort of frame it against the realities of a pro-AI Trump administration, of, you know, certain CapEx that already has been spent? What does that look like? Is it possible to make good on those promises?
Yeah, and again, it's very, very complicated. What I think is important to remember is that governors in states and frankly, state legislatures under the U.S. federal system have a tremendous amount of power to govern their energy mixes if they work together in regional organizations on issues like climate and sustainability and the types of infrastructure and the types of new economic sectors that they allow for or incentivize or promote in meaningful ways. They have a great deal of authority there. Not that that authority is not being challenged by the Trump administration, especially with regard to this specific issue. But I think we'll come to that maybe a little bit later. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, Democrats across the board in Virginia, New Jersey, Georgia, saw the way that the tide was turning around inflationary pressure with energy costs. Governor Lex Spanberger, for example, called her plan over the summer the Affordable Virginia Plan, and energy was a critical piece of that messaging. I'd love to talk about this one race because I remember being at the gym in the mornings and I would see his ads come up on the TV for John McAuliffe. And he was running here in Virginia's 30th district. And he flipped a seat that had been held by Republicans for decades right here in, you guessed it, Northern Virginia. He ran very heavily against data centers, both as an energy consumption issue, but also a land use issue. Talked a lot about protecting local farms. So you can kind of see where It does feel like Democrats really latched onto this issue, that data center growth could really be something that a lot of people could relate to and put some of their concerns and grievances on in a very tangible way. And again, we are only at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to this issue, when we look at how the data center build out is going to be happening. So your question then goes back to, what can people like Governor Spanberger, Mickey Sherrill in New Jersey, what can they realistically do about this? Well, again, they have a lot of authority within their state borders to regulate and set parameters around what kinds of infrastructure is being built within the state. Now, these AI investors would argue, and this I think is an entirely legitimate argument, that they're potentially going to be putting hundreds of thousands of dollars of tax revenue, possibly way more than that, into state and local budgets. So they're going to be employing people. They're going to be putting in valuable infrastructure in places that haven't had it for many years now. But at the end of the day, the governors have to look at this and really think carefully about what is going to be best, both for their long-term political future, as well as, is this meeting my state's goals? And as you mentioned, affordable energy, but also clean energy. Virginia has a very ambitious mid-century plan. I believe it's the Virginia Clean Economy Act that Governor-elect Spanberger has not walked back from. That by all accounts, it is looking now that she is going to intend to maintain the course on that legislation. So if Virginia is to meet those mid-century targets, the question then becomes, how much more power generation can you put on the grid, especially if you're talking about new power generation that is fossil-based? How are you going to meet those goals? And then which of those priorities do you focus on? So they're going to have a very difficult task here, I feel like, managing all of these different pressures and deciding, where do you draw the line that enough is enough?
It's certainly not a job I am jealous of, but you know, it's something that we have elected officials for a reason. They get voted into office to do their best to make good on campaign promises, at least in theory, right? I think that this is a good moment to talk a little bit about, you know, we've done a good job, I think, of going through the ways that the left versus the right have approached these issues of, you know, electricity and affordability specifically over the last year or so. I'm curious about what this might tell us heading into 2026 midterms. You know, obviously impossible without a time machine or a crystal ball, but can you share some of your expectations maybe for continued voter interest in this issue, you know, prioritization of energy issues by candidates in midterms? We've got a big slate of midterms coming up. Tons of governor races are on the line here. Do you think that this will continue to be a dominant political conversation for 2026?
Yeah, absolutely. From everything we can tell, inflation is going to remain pretty sticky here in the U.S. for the foreseeable future. And again, there's a number of reasons to believe that we are at the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the role of data centers in our wider economy. I was taking a look at a recent Bloomberg forecast that was showing, so right now in the U.S., I think of as of like late 2024, we were at right around 24, 25 gigawatts of data centers operating in the U.S. By 2035, the Bloomberg analysis I mentioned is projecting that we're going to be at 106 gigawatts of operating data centers, as in projects that have a reasonable chance of coming online and needing power, constant power, 24/7 power potentially. So this issue is only going to intensify and accelerate. And again, this is not just happening in Virginia and Texas. This is Pennsylvania. This is Ohio. This is California. This is states out west, Arizona potentially. So there's all these different areas that have not had to deal with this challenge before that are now going to be dealing with the influx of this new power demand as a result of this new technology infrastructure. So what I had thought might happen is that the Republican Party, led by President Trump, might attempt to do a bit of a pivot towards something like responsible AI. They're also, you know, talking about pivoting to energy affordability. But it's looking like now that they either don't want to do that, or they're not quite sure how to go about doing that. Because they just put out this quite expansive executive order, which effectively asserts federal primacy over states' abilities to issue laws and regulations over the artificial intelligence industry, which is pretty pretty significant in the U.S. federal system. It's pretty rare for the federal government to assert that level of authority. And that could really have impacts on how states can or have the ability to regulate AI energy usage. Many governors, including, I would note, Republican Governor DeSantis of Florida, a possible 2028 candidate for the Republican Party, has come out and said that this is completely ridiculous, that the United States federal government has no right to do this. But at the same time, they're also making big moves at through the executive agencies. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has been pressured to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking, basically telling the utilities, PJM specifically right now, that they have to figure out how to get these large load customers to connect faster. Basically, write the rules and tell us how you're going to do it, because we are considering this a national priority. Understandably, the utilities are not happy about that, and they're very nervous about this. Here in Virginia, Dominion Energy is going to court with the Trump administration next week over its Coastal Virginia offshore wind project. Part of what they have argued in their legal filings is that Dominion cannot possibly meet the incoming demand for energy in Virginia without this massive offshore wind project that they've already invested a lot of money into, that it's going to be essential for energy security, resilience, and reliability in the state of Virginia. So again, we're seeing a lot of growing tension here, and it feels like that the Republican Party so far is mostly on the side of focusing on building out this new, what they see as a nationally critical industry in artificial intelligence. The Democrats themselves, I would argue, are in a very complicated balancing act here. We've had a lot of press, a lot of talking about how Democrats are running with that energy affordability narrative. I think that's true, and I think that that will be very true as we're getting here into the midterms. But I would also caution that this isn't quite the whole story. And this really goes back to the fact that in the United States, power generation is supplied by a huge mix of fuels, and that really varies considerably from region to region. Nuclear energy, natural gas, I believe, is still well over 50% of all power provided in the U.S. Renewable energy is huge, especially in a lot of deep red Republican states. Hydropower, imports of electricity from Canada. There's huge regional variation in both the mixtures and what those mixtures cost and the available infrastructure to move energy region to region in the United States. So when Democrats are talking about energy affordability, almost by definition, that is pushing them back toward this all of the above approach. Something akin to maybe what we would have seen in 2010 under the Obama administration, that sort of mindset and dialogue and rhetoric around this issue. And I also note that this includes more willingness to tolerate new natural gas infrastructure, as well as a big bipartisan push for nuclear power. Neither of those fuel sources were especially popular with progressives, even just a few years ago. A little while ago, you couldn't possibly build a new natural gas pipeline in the state of New York. But now, Governor Hochul is relatively open about the possibility of a new pipeline getting Pennsylvania gas into New York City. And again, that is a sea change from where Democrats were even just a few years ago. So I do think Democrats are going to get very pragmatic very quickly. So I think the question then becomes, do they just run away from clean energy? Well, I think here it's more about framing than it is about actual policy positions. And clean energy stakeholders and industry groups are really taking this opportunity to make their own argument that if you want local, homegrown, affordable energy, congratulations, that's renewable energy here in the United States. You can make the argument right now that solar power in the U.S. is the cheapest power you can possibly put on the grid. Now, I can already hear people in the audience, bristling a little bit at that, because you have think about a lot of other factors, not just the LCOE. But the energy trade associations and these stakeholders that are really focused on clean energy are trying to argue that if you need more power and you need it right now and needs to be local and secure, then we're here. We're ready to go. Put us in. And I think that's fascinating because we've seen the Trump administration go so hard against all sorts of clean energy projects throughout the United States, canceling grants, pushing back against offshore wind specifically, closing public leases for new renewable energy. So again, it's this very interesting foil that these trade associations have this opportunity to make the case with our changing power consumption patterns throughout the country, that this is really where you need to be focusing if you're serious about addressing this challenge. So I would argue that we're not in an either or situation for Democrats right now. The answer here seems to be yes and, as in, and what else? So it's pragmatism and clean energy, not either or. And I think that Governor-elect Spanberger, she put out a brand new policy information sheet, I believe a couple weeks ago, and that was really focused in on the role of energy and energy affordability. But she talked a lot about energy efficiency, weatherization, energy storage, batteries, this big ambitious plan to grow tons of new battery storage here in Virginia, and making solar power, again, a very cheap power source, easier to access throughout the entire state. She's also said she'd like to rejoin the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that Governor Youngkin had already exited. And as I mentioned, she's not walking back the Virginia Clean Economy Act. So to me, that reads as we're going to do it all, potentially, if I want to be cliche here, all of the above, not so much that we are doing a wholesale shift from one thing to the other thing.
And such an important point to make, too, when we're thinking about 2026, there will be learnings from both sides on what happened in the elections in 2025 and how they might inform narratives and rhetoric heading into 2026. A lot of these words that are becoming central to political races in key states are words that are everyday jargon at a utility, weatherization and resource mix and things like, those terms that we're using on a daily basis. So I'm curious to hear your perspective on just kind of broadly speaking, what should the utility professionals listening to this think about elections heading into midterms in 2026? Obviously, issues that they're thinking about on a daily basis are now in the national spotlight. Is there any, advice or insight that you would offer to them on what it might mean for their work or for the ways that they could even talk to their family members about power and electricity prices? What's the message for utility pros?
Sure. And again, this is really important because we talked about that the average person is not, looking at a technical manual for how you install, a new power transmission infrastructure, that they're not, necessarily knowledgeable about those issues. And it's very easy, I think, to point to the utilities who are, we know are talking about ratepayer increases and increasing the cost of things. And that tends to not be popular, when you tell people, oh, we're going to do, we're going to increase the price of this thing you were already paying for. We're not giving you more of it. We're not giving you a better benefit or value. It's just going to cost more because we need to build all this other stuff. I think that for the utility specifically, it's going to be really important to be very clear about what you're spending and where you're spending it and why you're spending it. So for example, if you find yourself in a situation where you're very nervous about the direction that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is pushing you toward, that they're really pressuring you to be able to put on 20, 30 new gigawatts of large load customers over the next 5 years, then you need to be prepared to explain to the public why you are under pressure and where these rate increases are coming from, if that is genuinely the cause of where, those additional costs are headed. The other side of this is the transmission infrastructure problem. A lot of these utilities would be able to better manage a lot of these issues if transmission and distribution was better, faster, easier, less costly to build. I mentioned earlier that we have a comprehensive permitting bill that is now languishing in the U.S. Senate. Talking about permitting, talking about the role of being able to build stuff at reasonable costs more quickly is a part of this conversation. And by extension, tariffs are a part of this conversation as well, because that is continuing to result in inflationary pressure on some of these key components and just basic products like steel and different types of inputs for this infrastructure that these utilities need and are planning to use and will need more and more and more of as we're building out all of this new infrastructure. So it's a very complicated situation for sure. But I think a big part of this is just saying what you mean and being honest and open about where these challenges are coming from. And I think that's going to be especially important as they're talking to state legislatures and as they're talking to governors, being real about what the source of the problem is. And if it's not necessarily data centers, if it's something else that's a pre-existing issue, then be honest about that as well. But I do think that these utilities, these boards that govern these institutions are going to have to get a lot more comfortable with talking to the public about what's going on here, maybe than they have been before, because this is increasingly a very significant issue of public immediate interest.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like that's a mic drop and also a reason to send Power Perspectives to all of your loved ones, both in and out of the utility industry. But, you know, this is an issue that is increasingly going to be front of mind for people who are listening to this, for people who are just everyday people going to vote in the fall. Mm-hmm. So, Andrea, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing all of this with us. You know, honesty might not be easy to come by in politics, but hopefully it's a little easier to come by in the utility industry. I think this message of, you know, being honest about the challenges, the problems, the opportunities that lie ahead is a great one to leave our audience with. So I am ready to transition to our lightning round if you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's do it. So quick rapid fire, a couple questions to close us out here today. First up, if a candidate asked you for a one sentence campaign message related to energy today, what would your advice be?
I think that a big part of the messaging in and around data centers right now is this idea that energy is being sucked up for big tech billionaires to be able to use to become even bigger billionaires and become trillionaires and have trillion-dollar companies. And so when I think about if I was a candidate thinking about voters in my district or in my state who are very nervous about that and nervous about the implications of that, then I would go for a slogan, something like energy for people. Because I think that there is this growing sense of populism around energy and the need for energy to serve the needs of everyday people in and around our communities, ourselves, our neighbors, our friends, our parents. So I would say energy for people is maybe a tight, simple way to frame that, that I think a lot of folks could latch on to in different parts of the country.
Yeah, I dig it. It's like, put it on a button. I'm ready. All right. Next up, what misconception about energy do you wish you could correct for the typical voter?
Again, this gets into how complicated this issue area is. I think that I just want to note that all forms of energy have pros and cons. I think over the last several years, we've tended to increasingly think about energy as an ideologically driven issue. And with every form of energy, whatever it is, there are things about them that work great in certain contexts and things that do not. Certain types of energy work really well in New England, but would work terribly in coastal California. There are always advantages and drawbacks, and there are always problems with every type of energy that you have to resolve and mitigate in some form or fashion. So I think that we could really help ourselves a lot if we move past energy as a political football and instead get back to a mindset of how we maximize our ability to meet different goals at the same time. Can we do affordable and do clean and do reliable and do sustainable? I think it would help us so much if we, in especially our politicians and our leaders, could stop talking about energy as being good or evil, you know, like we're in like Lord of the Rings or something like that. But instead thinking about energy as a tool and part of our toolkit and thinking about getting the right tool for the job in certain circumstances and being prepared to mitigate and resolve those issues and those discrepancies where we see them to get to all of the goals that we want to get to.
Yeah, totally. Such an important point and one that I'm glad you made on this episode. And my final question for you here before I let you go, do you have a recommendation for it could be a book, an author, a publication, a media outlet that our listeners might want to check out if they want to go deeper on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll take the opportunity to plug my affiliation at the Atlantic Council. You mentioned at the top, I'm a non-resident fellow there. The Atlantic Council is doing a lot of really interesting and important work right now on the role of artificial intelligence in the U.S. U.S. economy. I believe their initiative is called AI Across AC, and that is cross-cutting across the Council's 16 regional and issue-specific centers, including my center, the Global Energy Center. And they're really focusing in, too, on a really promising area, I think, for analysis in geopolitical strategy around the role of artificial intelligence in the AI revolution, how that's impacting foreign policy in a big way. So stay tuned for more on that. I would fully recommend you all checking out Atlanta Council's website to learn a bit more about that and see the work that that all of our analysts really are putting into this very fast evolving space.
Absolutely. We will put some links in the show notes, so make sure to check those out. Andrea, again, such a pleasure to have you on the show. Always so insightful and you know, with a conversation this impactful and important. It's wonderful to have somebody who has such a breadth of knowledge and so many great stats to pull as well. So thank you so much for joining me today on Power Perspectives. It was wonderful again.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Wonderful. And thank you to all of you for listening. Once again, I am Kinsey Grant Baker. This is Power Perspectives, and I will see you next time.